watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
What happens when you combine the schooling we get with the media we get? A cradle-to-grave system of what the early 20th century journalist and social theorist Walter Lippmann called manufacturing consent. He considered this a good thing because he believed that most people in a modern industrial society were not up to the task of running a democracy, that they could no more grasp it than theatergoers arriving during the third act of the play. And these decisions should be left to an elite class of specialists. But as we've been hearing in our ongoing readings of the underground history of American education, most of the population has been, to extend the metaphor, deliberately detained from arriving at the theater on time. As the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould wrote in The Panda's Thumb, I am somehow less interested in the weight and convolutions of Einstein's brain than in the near certainty that people of equal talent have lived and died in cotton fields and sweatshops. How different would the world be if we heard the perspectives of those people in our schools, in our media, with the same force as we are made to hear those of the owners of the cotton fields and sweatshops. I was over 30 and a college graduate before I ever heard, for example, anyone explain the connection between wealth and poverty, or how chronically presidents and governments lie to bring nations into wars and who really benefits from those wars. I came across these ideas and others quite by chance on a struggling community radio station operated by the Pacifica Foundation in Los Angeles. I'm angry that I wasn't taught this in school, nor were my fellow citizens, and that I came very close to never learning what was actually going on. Most people never do, which is why we live in such a predatory society full of unhappy, alienated people standing on the edge of an ecological meltdown. I'm Lynn Gary, and this show is on Welcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren, and welcome to listeners of WKNH in Keene, New Hampshire, who organized to bring more than 20 hours of news and information programming from Pacifica and other community producers to their airwaves, and are now producing some great shows of their own as well. It's apropos for this week's program, in which the movement to free the media will be the centerpiece of the theme to end the mental slavery of manufactured consent.
Man away, hide the evidence from the light of day, while those responsible are free. Can't fire the rich, lay the poor to rot, steal from the bottom to kill the top. One at the swell is solidarity. My people are rising, my people are rising, my people are rising up. My people are rising, my people are rising, my people. Chillum Castle without igniting the righteous passion to turn the power around. What the Constitution guarantees, freedom of assembly and the freedom of speech. We demand it on the streets. My people are rising, my people are rising, my people are rising up. My people are rising, my people are rising, my people are rising up. Seattle, Davos, DC, LA, Chavez, Paris, Quebec City. My people are rising up. From California to the New York Island, crops and mountains, seas and oceans, cities, farms, factories. My people are rising, my people are rising, my people are rising up. My people are rising, my people are rising, my people are rising up. My people are rising, my people are rising, my people are rising up. People are rising, my people are rising up.
In our reading from John Taylor Gatto last week, he documented how a concerted attack was made on education through the media, trying to manufacture a consensus that education needed to be more practical, which was defined as teaching children to be useful employees of the rising corporate class. This was possible because the ability to produce and distribute media has always had an economic barrier. This ownership situation has favored the transmission of ideas advantageous to economic elites and led to their ability to remain politically elite as well. Every time a new mass medium has emerged, radio, TV, cable, the internet, we've been promised a new venue for popular education and dialogue, and each time it's been hijacked by corporate interests with the help of their allies in government. The common spaces for public discourse have been increasingly privatized as properties to develop revenue streams, and our communities transformed into media markets, and the people to demographics to be accessed for advertising. Over the past several years, an organization called Free Press has formed to bring together a coalition of grassroots media makers, sympathetic public officials, frustrated professional journalists, scholars, and community activists to fight for public interest in and public access to media. Last weekend, several thousand people convened in Memphis, Tennessee, to teach, learn, and organize. Over the 3 days, there were more than 100 workshops, caucuses, and plenaries on a wide range of media-related subjects. A great many of these have been archived online at freepress.net, and I recommend you check it out. This week, I've selected a few of the presentations that complement the reading from Gatto's book that will be at the end of the program. We're going to hear first from a member of Congress, then a professional journalist, a former State Department propagandist, and a scholar on how privatization and consolidation have been used to bring censorship and propaganda through the back door. We're going to begin with U.S. Representative Maurice Hinchey, well known to his constituents in Ithaca, listening on ICR 88.1. And just a note for Finger Lakes listeners, there will be some important announcements of coming events following Hinchey's talk, so you might want to get something to write with in the next 20 minutes or so. Here's Ben Scott of Free Press, who will introduce Maurice Hinchey.
Our next speaker, Congressman Maurice Hinchey, is a progressive Democrat who has represented New York's 22nd District for the last 14 years. He is a member of the powerful House Appropriations Committee, which allocates funds to the federal budget. And I'm pleased to say that he's recently been named to the subcommittee, which has jurisdiction over the FCC's budget. A tireless fighter for a free, diverse, and independent media, Congressman Hinchey founded the Congressional Future of American Media Caucus in April of 2005. He chairs the caucus, which is composed of House members who believe in an accountable, diverse, fair, and independent media. The goal of the Future of American Media Caucus is to educate members and their staffs about the media issues coming before the Congress, and to ensure that all parties, especially the American public, have a chance to participate in the vital debate over media ownership policy. Congressman Hinchey is also the author of the Media Ownership Reform Act, which is a sweeping measure that would, among other things, restore the fairness doctrine. We expect great things from Congressman Hinchey and his continuing leadership in the 110th Congress. Please join me in welcoming him, Congressman Maurice Hinchey.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here once again for this third National Conference on Media Reform. I'm very happy to say that I was at the first and the second one, and it's great to be here for this third one. And I want to thank all of you for being here. And I know that you're here because of your interest in this particular issue. And it is, I think, the most important issue confronting this democratic republic, the most important issue confronting the people of our country. We are, in some ways, very fortunate, because we are living at a moment in history which may in fact determine the future of our country for decades, maybe centuries, maybe forever to come. A lot of what is going to happen in the future is going to depend upon what takes place now, because of the fact that we do live in this critical moment in history. Now, you know, you think back in history and you say, well, there are a lot of critical moments, and there are a lot of times that have been interesting and a lot of things that have been challenging. But at this particular moment, we're facing one of the most difficult problems that we have ever faced in this country since the beginning. We've been around now for 230 years. What do we have? We have an administration in Washington that has falsified information to the Congress of the United States and to the people of our country to justify this illegal and unnecessary so-called war on terrorism, which they are carrying out in Iraq, a country that did absolutely nothing to us to justify the illegal and unnecessary attack that they perpetrated on that country. And now we are engaged in an occupation of that country, which has been going on now for almost 4 years. Almost 4 years. Longer than the Second World War. It has now cost this country, just the operation in Iraq, has now cost the people of this country more than $400 billion. And that amount is going up by more than $8 billion every month. When you look back on this, you wonder, how was it possible that the Congress of the United States could have voted to give this president that authority? And how was it that so many people all across this country, shortly after, or immediately after, actually, the attack of September 11, 2001, which the president unjustly and deceptively used to justify that illegal attack on Iraq, how was it that so many people all across this country bought into it, just accepted it, said, yes, we need to go invade Iraq, when they had absolutely nothing to do with the attack of September 11th. And whatever weapons programs they had in Iraq were delivered to them going back to the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration. Whatever chemical and biological weapons they may have had were given to them or authorized to be given to them by other countries by those two administrations. And in those two administrations, you had Rumsfeld and Cheney and a whole host of other people who are the worst aspects of this particular administration and who have formulated much of the policy that we now find ourselves so deeply engrossed in, and so challenging, and so much constituting so much danger to the future of our country. One of the ways in which that happened was the coverage by that circumstance and that situation and what the president and other members of the administration were saying, the coverage of all of that in the American media, newspapers, radio, television, particularly the right-wing oriented media, operations like Fox Television, for example, Sinclair Radio, and others that are dominated by the right wing. Talk radio, which is almost exclusively, it's slightly not exclusively anymore, but almost exclusively, neoconservative, right-wing, radical, even neo-fascist in their approach to the political process and what needs to be done. That's how that happened. Even in some of the biggest and most important and best newspapers in the country, there was a con job by some of the reporters who had been embraced by people in this administration, fed false information, which they then fed to the American people. And you know, I'm sure, about that. So that's how this happened. And because that happened, as a result of the information that was given to the American population and the way in which it was given, should make every single citizen in America deeply, deeply troubled and concerned about the future of this country. How is this going to happen again? What are they going to do the next time? How are they going to twist and distort the information? What kind of lies are they going to tell in the future to justify illegal and inappropriate actions that they will take, which will jeopardize the quality of this democratic republic and may, in fact, end this democratic republic? Because that is the objective of many of the people who are involved in this situation. That's what they want to do. How did all of this right-wing radio come about? How did this domination of the media by neoconservative perspectives and points of view happen? Well, some might say that it just evolved over time. It happened accidentally, maybe coincidentally. But the fact of the matter is that that isn't true. The fact of the matter is that it happened purposefully, objectively, in a very calculated and planned way. And it began back in the 1980s. And the first major success they had was in 1987, when, while the Reagan administration controlled the Federal Communications Commission, they aggressively began the process of media consolidation. And they counteracted a process which had been involved in our country from almost the very beginning, which was that everyone gets the chance to speak, everyone gets a chance to express themselves, everyone has an opinion, and whatever opinion they have the opportunity and the right to talk about it and to express it to other people and to engage in conversation. And the important thing about that is very simple. No one of us knows everything. No one of us understands the complete truth. None of us are perfect, not by any means. We are all grossly imperfect. And the only way that we can improve our understanding is through the interaction that we have with others, by listening to their points of view, by hearing their ideas. Because by listening to their perspective and observing their ideas and entertaining their ideas, that promotes new ideas in our own mind. That's the way the system works. That's why we have developed in the way that we have. That's the basis of progress in the human species, and particularly in this country, where we have had this kind of freedom and openness from the very beginning. In 1949, the Federal Communications Commission did something very important. And what they did that was very important was based upon the experience of the Second World War. Fascist countries across Europe dominated the political circumstances in each of those countries by dominating the political discussion in each of those countries. Radio was brand new, and they took advantage of the fact that you didn't have to go out into the center of the community in some way and stand on a soapbox or something else and talk to people. You could now do it in a different way. You could do it by broadcasting it all over into people's homes and businesses and various places. And you could control all of the information that went out. And we saw that happen in Spain, in Germany, in Italy, a number of other countries that became dominated by the right wing, by fascist governments. That's how they effectively took over those governments and how they maintained them. So the Federal Communications Commission here in America said that, as it had from the very beginning back in 1934, said that the airwaves, the broadcast system, is not owned by anyone. It's owned by everyone. The only people that own the broadcast system, the airwaves to broadcast radio and then later television, the only people who own that system are the American people. They're the ones who own it. And if you own the mechanisms to broadcast over part of that spectrum, and you are licensed by the federal government to do so, because the federal government is supposed to be looking out for all of the population, all of the people in our country, not just a few, not just the corporate interests, but the people's interests all across America. If you are licensed to broadcast on a part of that spectrum, and you have a political point of view, you have the right to express that political point of view. However, if someone else in the community to which you are broadcasting has a somewhat different point of view or an opposite point of view, and they want to express their opinion on your radio station because they are part of the owners of the broadcast system, they have a right to do so. And you, as the owner of that broadcast system, that radio station or that television station, you must give them the opportunity to express that point of view so that we can continue this system of having different perspectives, different opinions, so that we can all benefit from the knowledge and exposure to those different points of view and different perspectives. But in 1987, the FCC under the Reagan administration wiped that provision of the Federal Communications Commission off the rules and regulations of the FCC. And they, in effect, said that only the corporations, only the businesses that own the broadcast companies or the radio stations or the TV stations, only they can express their political point of view, and they don't have to have any concern or care about any other perspective, whatever it may be. That's what the Federal Communications Commission said under Ronald Reagan. The Congress of the United States responded. It said, wait a minute, the FCC can't do this. This provision, this equal access clause or this fairness doctrine, has been in the rules since 1934. You can't just take it out like that. And so they passed into law through both houses of the Congress that regulation that had been in the rules, that provision which had been in the rules and regulations of the FCC. And it was sent over to the White House, where it was vetoed by Ronald Reagan. And by vetoing it, he said very, very clearly to everybody who wanted to pay any attention that this wasn't some idea of somebody in the FCC. This was an idea that came out of my White House. This was an idea that came out of the political right wing. This is an idea that we are pushing forward because we want to dominate the political discussion in this country. We do not want people to have opportunity for other points of view. And the reason for that is because we know that if we allow a fair and open and free discussion of all the issues about the economy, about the environment, about energy, about international relations, then inevitably, in almost every case, we're going to lose. The right wing is going to lose. The only way to win is not to allow that free and open discussion, not to allow people to have the opportunity to combat us, not to have the chance to present other points of view which are contrary to ours. And that's what they did beginning in 1987. And that situation has been going on ever since. And it has to change. If this democratic republic is going to continue to succeed, it has to change. You see what's happening in the White House. You see what's happening with this administration. You've got this illegal war, and based upon this culture of fear that they have created and propagated and cultivated, They are now saying to us that we're involved in an international war on terror. And to try to make that more palatable, more acceptable to people, they go and bomb a place in Somalia. Or they go into a diplomatic office in northern Iraq and Kurdistan. And in Kurdistan, the Kurds have set up essentially an independent part of Iraq. They go in there and they attack the Iranian consulate, and they capture people out of that consulate. And they are jacking up, as you heard the president in his speech the other day, jacking up the idea that we are going to have to take additional action against places like Iran and Syria. Because they believe that the only way that they're going to maintain power is by maintaining this culture of fear that they've created in this country. That's the circumstances that we're confronting, and that needs to change. So you have an administration that, based upon that, is now investigating communications between people in the United States. And the president, just a week or so ago, said he can even open anybody's mail that he wants to. You have a president that is violating not just the law, but violating basic provisions of the Constitution. You have an administration that says the idea of habeas corpus in our country, which has been around for many, many years, even before the founding of America, goes back to the early days of the emerging democracy in Great Britain, that's gone by the board. We're not going to accept that anymore. We can capture anybody we want to, hold them as long as we want to, not bring them to trial, not make any statement about why it was that we captured them or why we keep them in prison. That's what they continue to do, violating the law and violating basic provisions of the American Constitution. And they know that the only way that they can get away with that is by dominating the media. If you control the information that people receive, you can therefore control the ideas that they hold and the actions that they take based upon that information. So this conference, this now third in a series of conferences, is critically important, and all of us have got to be involved in this issue. That's why I set up the Future of American Media Caucus in the House of Representatives, to try to bring members of the Congress together to fight these issues and to maintain openness and freedom, particularly freedom of discussion, in our country. And also why I've introduced the Media Ownership Reform Act. The Media Ownership Reform Act, of course, had been introduced in the Republican-dominated Congress, but nobody paid any attention to it. Now the challenge to the Democratic-controlled Congress is, how much attention are we going to pay to it? How much attention are we going to pay to this issue? And are we going to be strong enough to make the changes that are necessary to maintain openness of discussion and freedom for the exchange of views and access to all information in this democratic republic? That's a responsibility that we now bear in the Congress of the United States. And I'm happy to say that this bill is going to be introduced this year, not just in the House of Representatives, but it's going to be introduced in the Senate as well, because we have some new senators over there too, new people over there in the Senate. And one of them is Bernie Sanders from Vermont, and he's going to be introducing this bill in the United States Senate. So it'll be introduced in both houses. And what the bill does, it reinstates that equal access clause. It reinstates the provision that just because you own a radio station, you don't own all the ideas and all the information that is broadcast out of that radio station. That you have to provide access to anybody who has a different point of view on a political issue. And if Rush Limbaugh goes out there and shoots his mouth off, somebody else has got to come up and say, Rush, you're full of baloney. Here's the real facts. Here's what really happened. And if any other right-wing radio so-called talk show host continues to do the same thing, once this legislation passes, all of that stuff will end. And the American people will then begin to get both sides of the issue. Or several sides, or many sides, or however many sides there are. They will have access to all the information. That is basic, fundamental, and essential to the future of our country. So these are the things that we're doing. And in order to accomplish them, we need your help. This cannot be done. This cannot be achieved without your help. One of the things that we have to realize is that when you're in politics, when you're a politician, when you are engaged in trying to be elected, and if you are elected, then reelected, you have to be able to communicate to the people in your congressional district or in your state, whatever the dimensions may be. And you rely to a great extent on the media in the communities that you represent. And so therefore, for some members of the Congress, it's very difficult to stand up for legislation like this, which says to the corporations that own the newspapers and the radio station and the TV station that you're for openness and freedom, and you just don't want their particular point of view to be out there broadcast over those radio and TV stations. You want it to be open. In other words, what I'm saying is that it's going to take public pressure on a number of members of the Congress in order to get them to wake up to this idea and have the courage to step forward and confront this circumstance and to be in favor of putting our country back on the right track again, so that a president like George W. Bush can't get away with lying over and over again, and can't get away with intimidating people over and over again, and can't get away with violating the law and the Constitution over and over again. All of you have got to be involved in this. So when you go back to your communities, wherever they may be, whatever state it is, please be in touch with your United States representative in the House of Representatives and your two United States senators. Ask them to get involved in this issue. Ask them where they stand. What do they think we ought to be doing to get our country back on the right track again? What are they going to do to make sure that people get all the information they need in order for the people to be able to make the right decision about who they should elect to represent them, whether it's in the state legislature, the town board, the Congress, or the White House? So that's why this meeting here today is so critically important, and that's why your attendance here is critically important. I hope that all of us will continue to work on this issue, because if we do, we can get this country back again where it was in the past and where it needs to be in the future. A free and open society, a democratic republic based upon openness and the free exchange of information and ideas. Thanks very much.
U.S. Representative Maurice Hinchey of the 22nd Congressional District of New York State, speaking at the 3rd National Conference on Media Reform last weekend in Memphis, Tennessee. We'll hear more from the conference, but first some announcements for Finger Lakes listeners. A demonstration to end the occupation of Iraq will take place January 27th in Washington, D.C. Buses have been chartered from Ithaca and Syracuse. If you're interested in taking a bus from Ithaca, there will be 2 buses leaving on the evening of Friday, January 26th, around midnight, to arrive in D.C. in time for the march. A community bus will leave from the Green Street bus station, and a student bus will leave from Baker Flagpole on Cornell's West Campus. They'll return to Ithaca the following night about the same time. Tickets are sliding scale, $60 to $80, and are available at Autumn Leaves Used Books on the Ithaca Commons. There will also be ticket sales at Cornell and Ithaca College. For more information about tickets, contact Chris Chillis at cmc226@cornell.edu. cmc226@cornell.edu. More information on the march can be found at unitedforpeace.org. To leave from Syracuse, buses will leave there at 2 a.m. the night before the march and return 24 hours later. Those tickets are on a sliding scale from $45 to $75. The buses are being arranged by the Syracuse Peace Council. You can get more information from them by calling 472-5478, 472-5478, that's in 315, or on the web at peacecouncil.net. This next announcement is especially for Schuyler County folks. The toxic sewage sludge spreaders are poised to invade Schuyler County, and a community meeting has been called for We the People to form a Citizens Environmental Committee. The first organizing meeting will take place this Wednesday, January 24th, at 6 p.m. at the Rural Urban Center on Broadway in Montour Falls. Valerie Gardner and Jack Ossant will speak about the land application of sewage sludge and the community options for addressing this issue. I'm sorry, there's no contact number. Just show up at the Rural Urban Center in Montour Falls Wednesday, January 24th at 6 p.m. Hope to see you there. The following afternoon, Thursday, January 25th in Ithaca, Farmer Joel Salatin, known as the High Priest of the Pasture, will speak at Cornell at 4 p.m. Salatin is the author of several books and is featured in Michael Pollan's most recent book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He's considered one of America's most innovative farmers. He raises grass-fed livestock using farming methods that mimic nature. And his mission is to develop agricultural prototypes that are environmentally, economically, and emotionally enhancing and facilitate their duplication throughout the world. This presentation is Thursday, January 25th at 4 p.m. on the Cornell campus in room 223 of the Plant Science Building. Metered parking is available at the Peterson lot at the corner of Tower and Judd Falls Roads. The presentation is free and open to the public. For more information, contact Jennifer Garner at jmb326@cornell.edu. jmb326@cornell.edu. Okay, now back to our next speaker from the media conference, one probably well known to you as the co-host of Democracy Now!, Juan Gonzalez. His work, however, is primarily as an investigative print journalist. He's been a columnist with the New York Daily News since 1987, as well as authored several books. This talk was given as part of a panel titled, Can Corporate Media Tell the Truth?
Thank you. I wasn't sure what to talk about today. I know Can the Corporate Media Tell the Truth is the title of this session, and I think that the reality is that there are times when the corporate or commercial media can tell the truth. I wouldn't be working for 28 years at some of these newspapers if I didn't think occasionally or most of the time, at least the reporting that I was responsible for could get at some of the critical issues that were facing our readers as well as the American people in general. But I think that it's not a question so much of can once in a while any media outlet have a clear representation or accurate representation of what is the issue or the news event that they're covering. But what I'd like to sort of get into, because I've been trying to get to the bottom of this now myself throughout my entire journalism career, but I've been especially in the last few years trying to study the issue more carefully, because I've been coming to these media reform conferences now for, I guess, more than a decade. Not just the three that Free Press has held, but the couple that Don Hazen organized before that. I think one in San Francisco originally and then another in New York now. So there have been about a decade of these where journalists and media activists have been trying to confront and deal with the reality of what is happening to the profession and to the ability of the American people to receive the necessary and adequate and accurate information they need to be able to function as citizens. But somehow, and I've read not all, but most of the McChesney books and most of the studies that have been done recently that have been trying to analyze this from a more historical perspective. But I still feel that we are all missing essentially a more accurate analysis of what is the function of the mass media in our society and what is the function of the mass media in modern industrial society particularly. And I think that's what I've been hard at work at now for a couple of years, and hopefully we'll have some sort of cogent analysis come out on this whole matter in the next year. But one of the things that I've been trying to grapple with is the mass media are essential components of the modern industrial society. The more democratic a nation is, the more necessary it is for those in power to be able to somehow or other affect what the masses of people see and believe, especially how they act and how they vote. Because in a one-person, one-vote society, everyone has equal power on election day. And that's a very dangerous thing. The more democratic, and I think this is critical, when you have a dictatorship, you do not need to control mass public opinion in the same way that you do when you have a democracy. So the more democratic an industrial society is, the more necessity there is to affect public opinion through the mass media. And I think that in the United States in particular, this has become critical because of the particular nature that our country has developed. Remember, unlike England, France, Germany, and the other great industrial nations, we're a settler nation. The nation was built up through territorial expansion. The reason we have so much mass media, the reason why we had so many newspapers in the United States, and there was local media as opposed to centralized media all emanating from the capital, was because of the way that the country was constructed. So that as soon as settlers got to a new territory and established a town, they needed a newspaper. They needed a newspaper, and eventually when they were able to form a state, they needed ways to communicate with each other. So the new elites that formed as the settlers moved westward needed newspapers to deal with the formation of their communities. And our nation needed newspapers because it was so big. The territorial expansion took such a long time and was over such a large territory that you needed communication. So as McChesney and others have pointed out the postal system became the major bulwark of the development of the commercial press in the United States, because the postal system's main job was to carry newspapers. The main job of the postal system for the first 100 years or so of the Republic was the delivery of discounted newspapers. The government was subsidizing the development of this huge press. So we have 1,400 daily newspapers in the United States, and that's down from what it used to be. The reason why I think we have had so much, quote, democracy and difference of viewpoints is because the different elites that were building these different states were constantly in battle with each other. Ronald Formosano has a very interesting book, The Transformation of Political Culture, where he links the creation of the mass political parties in this country to the development of a mass press in the 1830s in the Jacksonian period. So the reality is that our press was part and parcel of the development of the elites of the country creating communication and intelligence and commerce with each other. At a certain point, though, as the immigrant settlers brought in, as they brought in more and more immigrants and industrialization and class conflict developed, there was uprisings, and there were working men's presses that developed in the 1830s. The first working men's press in the 1830s, the unstamped press in England, there was a battle now because the new workers were beginning to have their own press. And so what happened is newspapers that used to have small circulation then began to create mass circulation papers. The Penny Press of Benjamin Day and Bennett and the others who began developing their papers in the 30s and 40s were reacting to the working class press that was developing and the class conflicts within the settler society. But there's another aspect of this, in which I'll get into more tomorrow in the issue on civil rights and the media, is that the settlers were battling among the white European settlers. There was another side of the press, and that was the conquered peoples of this expansion, the Native Americans, the African slaves, the Latin Americans in the southwestern territories that were incorporated into the growing settler state and eventually into the empire. And the battle to prevent African Americans, Native Americans, Latinos, and later Chinese from telling their own story, having their own press, being recognized as part of the overall American press, became another aspect of the battle between the commercial press and what I call the opposition press. See, because the real stories of journalism in America have been between the opposition press and the commercial press throughout American history. Upton Sinclair didn't write his exposés in any major daily newspaper. None of the great exposés of journalism occurred in the commercial press for the most part, because the commercial press, after the Jacksonian era, became an official press. It became an official press, and then eventually you had in the late 19th century, as the chains began to develop, as Scripps and Pulitzer and Hearst built their chains, you had then the development of real trust, the trust press. So this is corporate press today is nothing new. It's been the leaders of the major newspapers in America have always been part of the elite power structure of the country. The Boston Tea Party was organized in the offices of the Boston Gazette by Samuel Adams and the early proponents of freedom of the press. So from the very beginning of the rise of the Republic, the press has been linked to the development of the independence and the elite movement that came out of the American Revolution. So I think that this is not a new issue. We have to begin to get a better understanding of the political economy of how this has developed, because we're not going to be able to deal with the current situation unless we understand the historical development. The other thing that's not new, and I'll end with this, is the issue of war, the press and the war. We've heard a lot of complaints about the coverage of the Iraq War. This is nothing new. You go to the Mexican-American War, you go to the Spanish-American War, you go to World War I, World War II, Vietnam. It is very rare that the commercial press will oppose government in time of war unless there is a conflict in the ruling circles of the society over the war, as happened in the War of 1812 and has happened on rare occasions. Throughout the history of civilization, governments have always had to justify wars to their citizens. How else could they get them to fight? How else could they get them to fight unless they could convince the population that what they were doing was just? So every war that has ever occurred, governments have sought to justify those wars to their people. But in most cases, at least one side was wrong, and sometimes both sides were wrong. So the real test of any press, of any free press, is in time of war. The reason why his show or their show was removed just before the Iraq War was not accidental. You go back to World War I. The beginning with World War I and the mass mobilizations of populations for war, governments began to understand that mass media are not just a form of social control, they are a means for military victory. So the Creel Commission was set up during World War I, and censorship of the press in the United States was developed in World War I. And since that time, governments have sought to use the mass media to psychologically whip their populations into frenzy for war on a scientific basis. The whole development of the public public relations industry comes out of World War I and the attempts to be able to control mass populations in time of war. So this is a pattern that exists, and always in war is the real test of any press. That's the toughest time to stand up. When your government goes to war, to challenge your government and to say that your leaders prosecuting an unjust war or a war that has no foundation is the most difficult test. And that will continue to be so. It has been throughout history. It will continue to be so. It is just that sometimes we lose that historical perspective and we assume this is happening for the first time. It's not. This is a continual battle. And the battle over the class battles within the mass media, and how will working people be able to get their perspectives and their views expressed, and the battles between the subjected peoples of the American Empire, and how will the subjected peoples be able to get their story and their perspectives and views told, are the two critical questions that still face, I believe, the mass media in the United States, and why it's so important to have independent media. And I think that the technology at this time, as many people have said, creates the opportunity for at least having new wedges or new ways to overcome the systems that have been in place for a while. Because the real contradiction right now that the commercial media in the United States is facing is that the technology is outstripping the ability of the content producers to produce content. The technology is moving at such a rapid speed that government officials cannot legislate in time, and even the corporate chiefs are insecure about how the technology will develop in the future. So that therefore, because the technology is outstripping the ability of the content producers to produce content, the people have an opportunity. If they organize themselves, if they have a sufficient historical analysis, if they can pull together their forces, and as several people have said, avoid sectarianism, that we can create space for democratic media in the country. We just need to work at it hard. All right, so thank you very much.
Investigative journalist Juan Gonzalez. And this is Unwelcome Guests. And you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
Earth was dying, if they said this on the news, if they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse. If you could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, if you could see the consequences right before your eyes. If you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide. If you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts. What if you knew? You knew the bombs were falling, if they showed them hit the ground, if you could see the bodies flying, if you could hear the sound, if you could see the rubble where the hospital once stood, if you saw the child's lifeless limbs, would you hold them if you could? If you knew that they were lying, every time they spoke, for every laser-guided pinprick, there were lives lost in the smoke. If instead of just the generals, they had doctors too to describe the carnage of the cluster bombs, what if you knew? You knew what they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew? You knew that you were living in a huge conspiracy. Would you leave your suburbs, get out of your SUV? Would you hit the streets and fight for all our lives? Would you hold your ground when the stormtroopers arrive? If you knew that the whole planet depended on what you do now, would you take a man with the speed our times allow? If the pundits told the truth for just a week or two and real life was shown on TV, what if you knew?
Our next two speakers were part of a panel on propaganda and the press. The first is Professor Nancy Snow of Cal State Fullerton.
Nancy Snow is an author of several books on media and propaganda. Most recently, remind me of your most recent book, Nancy.
The Arrogance of American Power.
The Arrogance of American Power. And you've actually worked in the State Department as well, if I recall.
Yes, sir.
And you'll be talking to us about a chapter from Impeach the President, if you could.
Sure. Thank you. But in the mid-90s, I worked at the U.S. Information Agency and the State Department as, I guess you could say, a government propagandist. And there really is such a thing. USIA is no more officially as an independent agency. It's now part of the State Department. So everything that we did at USIA is under the rubric of Dr. Rice and Karen Hughes, you may be familiar with. She came after Charlotte Beers. Charlotte Beers was one of my favorites right after 9/11. Who became the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. Public diplomacy is a euphemism, which in propaganda we use a lot of euphemistic terms, a euphemism for propaganda because, of course, in the United States, we like to believe that we don't engage in propaganda. And the only time that we have to use propaganda is when we are trying to target our overseas friends, trying to win hearts and minds, as we're doing in many places across the planet. I'm quickly becoming a stand-up comedian when I give these talks on propaganda. At any rate, I really am here to give you all some good news, because my chapter in Impeach the President, and I'm here with the co-editor, Peter Phillips, I highly recommend it. Not so much my chapter, the book. But I write about propaganda, lies, and patriotic journalism. And indeed, I wrote the chapter a year and a half ago. And of course, the book just came out in September. And the good news is that we are not as duped a people as we once were. So let me just share some of the statistics, just to go back in memory lane. One of the aspects of the violations of public trust, I was asked to lay out the Bush-Cheney warring propaganda. So the first point I made in the chapter, and I can only go through a few, is the big lie. And of course, we know the big lie was that most violated the public trust was the Iraq link to 9/11. And public attention for many months and years was diverted from real security issues, i.e. no capture or the alleged capture of Osama bin Laden, the security on domestic airplanes and seaports were diverted to a trumped-up security threat overseas that required an elective invasion on the part of the U.S. military. While Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld provided evidence, no evidence, of any real link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. They repeatedly linked the two in prominent speeches, and we know we remember these speeches. You might ask yourselves, how can we live in a country where propaganda works so effectively? And I can tell you, when I travel abroad, one of the first questions that my overseas friends ask me, they're always perplexed because they say, while the U.S. government and the U.S. military targets them so often vis-a-vis propaganda, they said the real effect seems to be on the American public. So it's an irony to them.